maybe near the end when we have our quiz, you can all enter your answers. And I can do like I did with the high school class. The first three correct answers typed in, you know, got a point, and then we had a contest to see who could get the most points. If no one but one person got the answer, then the next two fastest typers copying their answer would get a point. So that you can play that game if you want to. All right. So let's try to use the chat. And as we go through, if I have time at the end, I would like to break into groups for really about maybe 2 or 3 minutes at the most. And I'd like you to think about some themes, some things we could learn from the Book of Judges that when we're done, our lives will be different. We'll think differently. We'll believe something that's maybe more strongly than we believe it now. We may be able to actually do something different as a result of studying the book. It's a little difficult for Judges as opposed to some book like Proverbs or James or something. But I think there are deep lessons, and sometimes the more hidden the lessons are, the deeper they are, and maybe the more they ought to affect our thinking. So that's just Marty talking. All right, let me see if I can share my screen. And this was the assignment, was to watch this movie. And I don't agree with every single thing in it. For example, I think he's a little harsher on Jephthah and Gideon than maybe we will be in kind of saying they had a pagan background. But, okay, that's a good way to think about it. And so if you want to watch that, do that. Nikki sent out the link. It's actually on this chart down here, but we won't look at it. I very aggressively divided the book into 7 lessons. I was going for 6, and I gave up. I went ahead and made it 7. And I've made the last two a fairly short. It's 2 to 3 chapters a week. So you could read those several times or listen to it, as I like to do. With an audio Bible. And hey, Chiliang, how are you doing? You need to go on mute, though. Can I do that, or can
you?
Got him. Okay. So anyway, you'll see we're doing a little bit over 2 chapters, 2.5 tonight, and that's typical. Quickly, the outline of the book is really 3 sections. You're probably familiar with this. And the first section we'll cover in this very first lesson. It's just through the first couple of chapters, and it kind of sets the tone. It also links backward to Joshua and the conquests, because, in fact, there's some sections that are repeated in that first chapter. But it also, I think, looks forward not only to the book of Judges, but also even some to the future. And part of what we'll do today is look at some of the references to cities and locations and a few other things. They're kind of cool because they're hooks that hook us to the past and hook us into the future and show Judges in its context. All right, so then the middle section is a list of the judges there. Of course, the 4 military judges that we have some record of the battle are Barak and Gideon, Jephthah and Samson, who are mentioned in Hebrews 11. Maybe as much for their own faith, maybe more so for what God did through them, of course. But there are other judges, which it's not clear they had any kind of military exploits, but they're listed. Jair, I think in particular, was a Transjordan judge. He looks like he just had a bunch of donkeys and maybe judged in various cities. But still, there was a sense that they all were judges in some way. And I refuse to get into an argument about whether Deborah ought to be in the military list or whether Abimelech was a judge or whatever. Somehow or another, some canonical number of 17 or something came up. I don't know, but we're not going to worry with that classification. And then the last 4, 5 chapters, I guess, are disturbing, as the Bible Project video said. I think that for an adult class, it's probably worth looking at from the standpoint of what we can learn about a culture in which everyone does right in their own eyes, which is a little different from every man did what was right in his own eyes. That second phrase implies they're thinking hard and trying to figure out what's right. I don't think that's what they were doing. They did something, and they just thought that was right because they did it. I think that every man did right in his own eyes is probably a better translation of that. Okay, so the organization we'll cover tonight is this, we'll call it the incomplete conquest of Canaan, covers the whole first chapter. You'll notice that Judah and Benjamin are listed together, and you can kind of see Simeon if you squint your eyes and look real hard, but Simeon's in there. But basically, what becomes known is the southern kingdom. and you'll see that that's kind of referenced in the way the cities are listed. So Judah and Benjamin, in a blue font on this chart, means they did a pretty good thing. They did, the conquest was successful. And a red line means that they were not successful or were defeated in some way, didn't finish the job. And then after that, the rest of the tribes, starting with Ephraim, and at the very end comes back to Dan, and we'll talk about why that might be so, even though Dan was in the south. Then there's the record of the broken covenant, chapter 2, 1 through 6, at a place that becomes known as Bochim. It's not clear where that is. It might be Bethel. It might be one of those places, but it became known as Bochim. We'll learn about why. And then there's the list of the actual cycle, which we always learn in the kids' classes. We go over the cycle. Well, it's kind of spelled out there in the latter part of chapter 2. And then there's a list of the nations in chapter 3, almost to say, get ready for trouble, right? Here's a whole list of nations that are going to be the source of conflict throughout the rest of the book. So that's that. Now, this is not the way I usually teach a class, but for this group, what I want to do literally is read the text. I'm going to pause at various places in the text and pull in external information or show some organizational principles. And so it will serve as somewhat of an introduction to the book as well. I don't know if this will work or not. Bear with me, okay? And my problem will be when I read the text, I want to stop and make a comment on a phrase. I want to try to read the whole page, then go back and remember the things that have to be said. Y'all can help me with that if you will. And I noticed that I don't have my chat window up. So, Nikki, if something cool comes into the chat, let me see if I can bring it up. Ah, there, I have it up now. Never mind. Okay. All right, you ready? Judges 1:1. Now, after the death of Joshua, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked the Lord, and I hope, see, here I go. I'm already doing it. The Lord, in all the versions except the American Standard, maybe the King James, really means Yahweh. And it's the way that English translations and long history of how that came about. But it really is the personal name of Jehovah. If you read the American Standard, that's what it says. You should think about Yahweh in contrast to Baal or Ashtaroth or Molech or the other gods. Whenever you see that, capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. Israel asked the Lord, which is a good thing to do, saying, who shall be first to go up for us against the Canaanites to fight against them? And the Lord said, Judah shall go up. Indeed, I have delivered the land into his hand. So Judah said to Simeon, his brother, come up with me to my allotted territory that we may fight against the Canaanites. And I will likewise go with you to your allotted territory. And Simeon went with him. And Judah went up. And the Lord delivered the Canaanites and Perizzites into their hand, and they killed 10,000 men at Bezek. So a couple of things. Notice they did inquire of the Lord, and that you'll see in the subsequent history of Israel, times when David did that, for example, things went well. When he didn't, they didn't go very well. So it looks like Judah not only is being successful here, but also doing it in a way in which they look for guidance from Jehovah, that is the personal God of Israel. Notice that Simeon is his brother. Do you remember it was Simeon? What? I thought all the tribes were brothers, right? There's 12 sons of Jacob. In what sense is Simeon a brother? Okay, I guess I'm not going to get fast answers. Everybody probably knows. You can type it in the chat if you want. All right, they had a common mother. Right. Reuben, yeah. Simeon, Levi, Judah were all the first four sons of what? Leah. Right. Yeah. Behold, it was Leah. Yeah. And so they went up. And notice, too, in the prophecy in Genesis 49, that Simeon and Levi, because they were kind of violent, when Jacob gave his prophecy and promise, he's going to say, I'm going to scatter them in Israel. And in a way, both Simeon and Levi end up kind of spread out with no really recognizable territory, Simeon being absorbed into Judah. But here, they're cooperating, so that's not bad. So notice that it's after the death of Joshua. And I just want to talk a minute about the timeline here, if I can get it to come up. If you add up the tenure of all the judges that are listed in the book, you end up with about 410 years. And there's an interesting verse in 1 Kings 6, which says that it came to pass in the 480th year after the children of Israel had come out of Egypt, and in the fourth year of Solomon's reign. So there's a suggestion that there's 480 years from the time they came out of Egypt until the fourth year of Solomon's reign. So now, warning, math is coming. Okay, so we're going to take, so math is coming. If I can take 4 years out for Solomon, I can take 40 more years out for David's reign, and I can take 40 more years out for Saul's reign, and I can take about 40 years for Samuel, who lived to be 80-something, and really overlap the reign of Saul, but before Saul, maybe about 40 years. And then Eli, maybe 40 years. And I don't know that these are sequential, but these are rough estimates. And then I go back to the Exodus and say, well, they were 40 years in the wilderness, and then there were 16 years in the conquest. You see where we're headed with this, right? So when you're done, you really only end up with about 260 years if you start at the death of Joshua, which is what that verse just said. Well, you probably know the answer is that the period of the judges spans on into the time of Samuel, most obviously. That's the first explanation. And I think you'll see in a quote from Jephthah why that's true. And secondly, it never really says that these judges served sequentially. In fact, it's pretty clear from the text in chapter 11, I think it is, the beginning where Jephthah and Samson are contemporaries. One's on the east, that is Jephthah dealing with Moab, and Samson's in the west dealing with the Philistines. So they're all contemporary and probably in a limited region at the time. So the likely period is 300 years, maybe a little bit more, and probably goes into the time of Samuel. You remember the later parts of the book are about Samson, and who's he fighting but the Philistines, and that's the whole context of, you know, Samuel and Eli and the loss of the ark, and all that is the battles against the Philistines down in the west. There's another, so this is the quote from Jephthah. As Jephthah is negotiating here about not going to battle, he reasons this way. He says, for 300 years, Israel occupied Heshbon, Aroer, and the surrounding settlements and all the towns along the Arnon. That's the Transjordan eastern side. Why didn't you take them during that time if they belonged to you, he argued to that king who claimed they were his at that time. And so really you can see from this period here to somewhere along in here, that would put Jephthah somewhere in this period of time about 300 years later. There's one other verse that's a little bit difficult, and that is when Paul was at Antioch of Pisidia, I think, and he was preaching there, recounting the history of Israel. And the most translations read this way: after Moses and the water, he gave them judges for about 450 years until Samuel the prophet. Well, there's no way to fit 450 years in there anywhere after the events he describes there. But there's another translation which the NIV goes with, and so does the ESV. I don't know if it helps or not, but basically that story that Paul's telling starts with the patriarchs, and it kind of starts there. So he may be saying from the patriarchs till the conquest is about 450 years, and then after this, God gave them judges until the time of Samuel the prophet. So that's one way to reconcile that. But I think that's just a pretty good picture of what we're talking about. It's definitely after the conquest. It's definitely before the United Kingdom, but how it overlaps with Eli and Samuel is not really clear how that works. Judges 1, verse 5. Paul is answering my questions. Thank you. That's a good example. You can read her answers. You'll know. And they found, this is Judah, of course, and Simeon working together. They found Adonai Bezek in Bezek. That's an interesting thing. And fought against him, and they defeated the Canaanites and Perizzites, and Adonai Bezek fled. They pursued him and caught him and cut off his thumbs and big toes. Adonai Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off, used together, scraps under my table. As I have done, so God has repaid me. Notice a different word for God there. And then they brought him to Jerusalem, and there he died. Now the children of Judah fought against Jerusalem and took it. They struck it with the edge of the sword and they set the city on fire. And afterward, the children of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites who dwelt in the mountains and in the south and in the lowland. Then Judah went against the Canaanites who dwelt in Hebron. Now the name of Hebron was formerly Kirjath Arba, and they killed these three, Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai. Okay, a few things to notice. Do you know what Adonai means? We're going to learn some Hebrew words, and it'll be on the quiz at the end. So what does Adonai mean? Anybody know?
Lord?
Yes, that's what it means. So it just means the Lord of Bezek. And no wonder he was in Bezek, because he was the Lord of that place. But we'll see that a few times. And that's an important thing to know. And you also find many cities that begin with Kiriath or Kirjath. And that just means city. So it just means city. The city of Arba, whatever that was the city belonging to Arba, perhaps. But those are important words. But you'll notice how successful Judah is being. Interestingly enough, what are the two prominent cities mentioned here at the very beginning of Judah's success? You can see them in the text. I put them in red, so maybe it's dumb to keep asking you these questions. But Jerusalem and Hebron. Now, we're going to learn in this chapter that Jerusalem really remained unconquered for a long time, several hundred years more, 400 years more. So why the prominent mention of Jerusalem? Does anybody know what in the past, before the book of Judges, would have made Jerusalem important?
It's where Melchizedek was from, right?
That's great, yes. Salem is what he's called. That's one. What else happened there? Well, Mount Moriah. Yep. Yes, Abraham. Seems quite very likely. That's where Abraham sacrificed Isaac, up on that hill there. So Jerusalem had some significance. Probably there's something mystical about Melchizedek. I don't know, but something important about it. But also, as Abraham sacrifices Isaac in a kind of foreshadowing of the Messiah, and God provides as a substitute in that place. So that's one city. What's the other city that's prominently mentioned of all cities? Could be some others, but you see Hebron or Hebron, however you want to say that. I understand that today, or maybe you're not allowed to go there today, but if you take a tour and you can get into that Arab-controlled area in Hebron, the Jewish folk who give you the tour are very proud of the fact that they know they own Hebron. If they don't own anywhere else, there's a place in Hebron that they own. Does anybody know why the Jews claim, or the Israelis now, claim to own Hebron? Yeah, not too hard. Yeah, I'm not going to be able to wait for answers. This is not working very well. So I'll tell you that Hebron is the place where the cave of Machpelah is. And I believe it was, what's his name, Ephron or something like that. And when Sarah died, Abraham needed a burying ground for her and him and this, you know, Jacob and others who would be buried there. And that's in Hebron. And it was kind of like the family plot. And so it's interesting to me that when the spies went into the land, so that's important about Hebron, very important. It was an important place from their point of view of their history. And you remember that Joseph's bones, I mean, there's a whole bunch of things that are very important about that, right? So that city is mentioned. The other thing about it is that the other faithful spy besides Joshua, whose name is Caleb, by the way, Joshua from Ephraim, who will become the dominant tribe in the north, and Caleb from Judah, the dominant tribe in the south, Caleb spied out that area, and he came back and asked Moses for it. He said, I want this area. And maybe he knew that it was also the family burying grounds, but it was very important. And you'll see that plays out in this story here. So two important cities, oddly, you might wonder why those two cities. And what's interesting is if you're in your Bible and look ahead, the mention of those two cities envelops this whole account of all that Judah did. If you look in verse 20 and 21, again, in reverse order, there's a mention of Hebron being given to Caleb and the children of Benjamin not being able to take Jerusalem and hold it. So you see those two important cities envelop, and they're in the south. They're in the territory of what became the southern kingdom. So here's a kind of a picture. See if I can draw on it safely here, if I can find my mouse somewhere. There it is. Okay, so the Israelites, you know, came in. They came across to the Jordan River. They crossed over. These are the so-called Plains of Moab, Mount Nebo is where Moses went up and was taken by God and died. And then there's a little place called Gilgal where they camped before they did their assault on Jericho and the walls of Jericho. But anyway, that was their entry into the land. And then next after Jericho was Ai, and then into this area, and then they went for the northern and southern campaigns. But you'll see some of these places. So Hebron is down here, Jerusalem's down here. Does everybody understand north is kind of up to the diagonal? The way this, I just like this picture because of the topography is pretty clear there. Anyway, this is kind of the southern kingdom. You should know that Jerusalem is right on the border of the territory of Benjamin, and Bethel is right on the northern area. So I didn't draw it big enough, but that's Benjamin in the middle there. And then Ephraim is up in this area, which includes Shiloh and other places. So you can kind of see a few places there. This is the area of the Philistines down here, Mount Carmel, this is the Megiddo, the Valley of Jezreel, Mount Tabor, where a lot of the battles are fought, Gideon and Barak and all are up in that area there. So kind of a nice map. I hope we can keep learning about the map, but you understand the Jordan River splits, and there are three tribes or two and a half tribes on this eastern side in this area called Gilead, which is not a tribe. It may have been a man's name, but it's a region that's kind of jointly occupied by Reuben, Gad, and the half tribe of Manasseh. So anyway, there's a map. All right, keep reading. How are we doing? Are y'all bored to tears? So I'm trying to break it up. I'm just reading the text, but I think I'm going to start marking on the text where I want to come back in. And Caleb said, whoever attacks Kirjath, now we know what that word means, right? The city of Sepher, and takes it to him, I will give my daughter Aksa as wife. And Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, took it, and so he gave him his daughter Aksa as wife. Now it happened when she came to him that she urged him to ask her father for a field. And she dismounted from her donkey, and Caleb said to her, what do you wish? So she said to him, give me a blessing. Since you have given me land in the south, give me also springs of water. And Caleb gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. I guess I will stop there to say. It's interesting to me, at the very beginning of this, there's actually a woman getting an inheritance and asking for things and getting it. And, you know, it's interesting because the book is not going to be kind to women. And I think generally mankind and society is not kind to women, when every man does right in his own eyes. And you're going to see pretty terrible things happening to women during the course of the book. But here at the beginning, you see with Judah honoring the past, honoring the promise of Moses. And so here she is given a blessing. And just so you know, your translation may say Negev, and that just means south in Hebrew. So there's another Hebrew word we need to learn and know. Now the children of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up from the city of palms with the children of Judah into the wilderness of Judah, which lies in the south, Negev, near Arad, and they went and dwelt among the people. And Judah went with his brother Simeon, there it is again, and they attacked the Canaanites who inhabited Zephath and utterly destroyed it. So the name of the city was called Hormah. And Judah took Gaza with its territory, Ascalon with its territory, and Ekron with its territory. Now, there are three cities there. I just want to come back and talk about those three. So the Lord was with Judah. They drove out the mountaineers, but they could not drive out the inhabitants of the lowland because they had chariots of iron. And they gave Hebron to Caleb, as Moses had said, and he expelled from there the three sons of Anak. It was interesting. There were giants in the land. Remember that's what the spies came and reported. Well, they were actually in the territory that Caleb went to, and he's one of the ones that said, we can take it. So to demonstrate that, he goes and takes it and destroys the giants, the sons of Anak, and the giants there. But the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who inhabit Jerusalem. So the Jebusites dwell with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. And there it is again, Hebron and Jerusalem. You see how that forms an envelope around this description of what really basically become the southern tribes later. And so what I was going to talk about. So interesting, in verse 16, I don't know if you know who the Kenites are, but that's another interesting thing to mention right at the very beginning. The Kenites are descendants of Jethro, or Hobab, one of those two names. It's Moses' father-in-law. Remember, Moses fled Egypt and he married that woman, I guess a Midianite, I'm trying to remember. But anyway, this is the descendants of Jethro. And you remember Jethro joined up with the Israelites as they started the Exodus. And he actually was a good counselor to Moses, if you remember, giving him some advice on leadership. But they're not Israelites, and they're going to show up over and over again. In fact, a Kenite will show up in the book of Judges in the person of a woman, a Jael, who kills the Sisera, right? Is that right, Paula? With a tent peg, right? And it's interesting why she had a tent peg. Why is she in a tent? There's just a lot of history around that. They show up again in Jeremiah 35 as an object lesson to the Israelites because of their faithfulness, contrasted to the Israelites' unfaithfulness. So a fascinating study about the Kenites. My point is this, non-Israelites doing well with the Israelites here. And we're going to see more of that. Of course, you've already seen some of it in Rahab, but obviously the story of Ruth and so on is another example of that. So it's not exclusively Israelites in a sense, but it is exclusively followers of Yahweh that are important. And again, here the Jebusites are just troublesome people, and they seem to have occupied Jerusalem. And despite the fact that earlier it looked like Judah struck it with the edge of the sword and burned it, they're still there. And the Benjamites can't get them out. Remember I told you Jerusalem is right on the border between Judah and Benjamin. And it ends up being a very, as you know, it becomes the city of God before it's all over with. But here in the book of Judges, it's just being mentioned. But it's interesting that the Jebusites are there in Jerusalem. Does anybody know David actually bought the spot of ground where the temple was built? And who did he buy it from? Does anybody remember?
Ornan is one of the translations, I think, but he has another name too.
Aruna is the other. That's great. And you happen to know what nationality he is? He is a Jebusite, interestingly enough. So even after David conquered the city, the Jebusites still lived there, as did some other people who weren't Israelites, like Uriah the Hittite and others that were. But they were faithful to Jehovah, and they were part of David's kingdom. So yes, Aruna Ornan was a Jebusite, and he had the. He owned that property, that very on top, way above the city of David, where David, you know, the angel of death stopped. David wanted to offer a sacrifice, and he bought that. So I just want to do a little geography right quick. I hope it's not too boring to me. It's kind of fascinating, and maybe I can give you some memory hints to help you learn where these are. If any of you have high school students, they should be able to fill this out because we worked on this over and over. I hope they can. But we'll start, you know, at the top of the list on the left where it says Judah, and Judah, and then Simeon. So Judah is pretty clear down here. Bethlehem, you notice some of these places. Again, Jerusalem right there on the border, and then Simeon somewhat absorbed into Judah down in the south. Now Benjamin is there. It's just the area just on the other side of Jerusalem. Again, Bethel separates Benjamin from Ephraim. And then Dan is the next chart, tribe over here to the west of Benjamin. And they just had trouble. And we're not to that part of the text yet. But before it's over, you know where Dan ends up, right? You know, they end up as far up north as you can get. In fact, so far north, so far from anything that they were able to take those peaceful people in Laish because there was no one to rescue them. They just lived too separated from anywhere. So the Danites ended up way up there. And then Ephraim, and I helped the high school kids remember this. You'll notice in the book of Judges that Ephraim is really troublesome. They're ornery. They argue. They end up actually having kind of a war with them. And I call them the pill. So this is the pill country of Ephraim, okay? And so that will help you remember that. And you know that that's where our famous first king of the northern tribes comes from, right? Jeroboam is an Ephraimite. And it does seem like they're pretty aggressive. And, of course, being the first son of Joseph who got the double portion and all that, I don't know if that played into it, but that was part of it. And then a big area here is Manasseh. And then there's Manasseh West or West Manasseh or whatever you want to call it. And this is East Manasseh over here in the Transjordan area of Bashan. Good for cattle, I suppose, is your bulls of Bashan up there. And then while we're on the eastern side, the other two tribes that, you know, helped with the conquest but then came back were Gad and Reuben. And again, this territory all through here is often called Gilead. Gilead, and that's probably named after a man, but it just became known as a region. It seems like it's usually associated with Gad, perhaps Manasseh. But that's where Jephthah worked. Jephthah's area was all over in here in the area of Gilead. It's frustrating to me. It'll say this man was a Gileadite, but it doesn't say what tribe it is. So I, you know, Danny always keeps track of all the tribes, but I can't quite figure it out. But anyway, that's Gilead is there. So going on up, you've got Issachar. And the way the high school kid remembered that. So this is the Carmel Range right here. And this is the Jezreel Valley. And valleys are great for chariots, right? Or they're great for cars, where mountains are not. So Issachar is the flat area where a lot of the battles were fought. But it includes Mount Tabor and other places. All right. So then you got Zebulun. You just have to remember that. I always remember Asher by the sea. That will come up in Deborah's poem. And then there's only one that left. That's Naphtali, and that's the tribe of Barak, because of the king Baron Hazor deserved to be taken out. And Deborah said, hasn't God commanded you to do that? And I guess he had. And so he did. So that's a picture of where the tribes are. And that will be important as we read through the next section. So far, we've looked at Judah, Simeon, and Benjamin. And now we're going to kind of read the rest of these. And you'll notice the order is top to bottom on the left, but bottom to top on the map there. And the house of Joseph also went up against Bethel, and the Lord was with them. So the house of Joseph sent men to spy out Bethel. The name of that city was formerly Luz. And so I want to come back and talk about it. Again, I think we're linking these cities to important things in the past, not to mention the future in this case. When the spies saw a man coming out of the city, they said to him, please show us the entrance to the city, and we'll show you mercy. He showed them the entrance to the city, and they struck the city with the edge of the sword, but they let the man and all his family go. And the man went into the land of the Hittites and built a city and called its name Luz, which is its name to this day. To this day. That doesn't mean to 2020, by the way, but until someday, right? However, Manasseh, that's the other, you know, y'all know the house of Joseph, right? What are the two sons? Ephraim and Manasseh, right? So, however, Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Bethshan and its villages, or Taanach and its villages, or the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, the inhabitants of Ibleam and its villages, and the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages, or the Canaanites were determined to dwell in the land. And it came to pass when Israel was strong that they put the Canaanites under tribute, but did not completely drive them out. You see what's happening here in the sequence. It's not going well. Okay. Nor did Ephraim drive out Canaanites who dwelt in Gezer, so that the Canaanites dwelt in Gezer among them. So, interestingly, that this section, second section, remember I was telling you that we've covered kind of the southern kingdoms now. Now we're going to the northern kingdoms. And what city does it start with there? There are a lot of cities you could have started with. It started with Bethel. Does anybody know anything about Bethel from the past? Is that an important city in Israel's history? Yeah, Brigham's talking, but I can't hear him. But I'm sure what he's saying is that's where Jacob had his dream, right? And the ladder going to heaven and everything. So more Hebrew here. The word Beth, everybody know what that means? Beth means... it means house. So Bethel, El or Elohim is kind of a plural, but I am on the end. So Bethel is the house of God. And that's what Jacob named it long time ago, long time before this, right? And I guess while it was still Luz, he just called it Bethel because he had that experience there, right? But anyway, so Bethel is an important city, and that's where Jacob had that dream. And you all understand that the children of Israel knew about that because of the writings of Moses. It gave them their history of the first five books as they were at Sinai and then as they wandered and were about to go into the land. Okay. So I'm not going to cover it, but down here, these are interesting little references. Down here in the bottom is the prophecy that Jacob made about Joseph as he was right near the end of his death. I want to talk for a moment. We saw to this day, and we saw that earlier, that the Jebusites are still in Jerusalem to this day. And now I'd like to talk about the date of the writing of Judges. So this is, if you think of this as the commercial break and the other is the real class, or maybe this is the real class and the other is the commercial break. I don't know, but some, we're just kind of trying to go back and forth. The children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who inhabit Jerusalem. So the Jebusites dwell with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. Does that suggest to you a kind of a bound on the time of writing of this book? So you think it would be before or after the Jebusites were finally driven out of Jerusalem? What's it saying there?
It would be written before the Jebusites were driven out.
Yeah, that's right. So at some point before the Jebusites were driven out, well, when were they driven out? Well, it was when David was 30 years old and he'd begun to reign, and he'd already reigned in Hebron. Hey, Hebron again. Interesting. Hebron and Jerusalem. Now, remember, those two cities were listed before. Were they important in David's reign in the future?
Yeah,
that's David reigned in Hebron. Then he moved to Jerusalem once he kicked the Jebusites out, and then the temple and everything ended up there and so on. But anyway, he reigned over Judah 7 years, 6 months, and in Jerusalem 33 years, right? So the king managed to take. So he took the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David, and that's the lower part where he ended up living. And, of course, the temple was up the hill a ways, which he bought later, okay? Now, there's another passage in the book, and I'm jumping ahead to chapter 18 now, and that's a description of when the Danites had to go up way to the north to find a place to live. And it says they set up for themselves Micah's carved image. Long story, we'll get to that later, which he made all the time the house of God was in Shiloh. Now, does that seem like a before or after statement? In other words, these Danites are up there, and the carved image was set up and stayed there the whole time the house of God was at Shiloh. What does that imply? The way it's worded, Nikki.
No longer in Shiloh?
Yeah. So it's somehow or another, it's after the ark got taken out of Shiloh for some reason. Now, I don't know if you remember the story about the ark being in Shiloh, but that's where it was for quite a while until big battle against the Philistines. You remember that? This is in Eli's day. Eli's old and fat, but his two sons are kind of running things, seems like. And they get the ark, the covenant, and they take it out, and they're going to take it into battle, and a big cry, and the Philistines are first frightened, and then they're strengthened, it seems like, and they capture the ark, and they have the ark for a long time, and it wanders around, kills Philistine gods and boils and everything, and finally ends up in another Israelite's city, but it stays there until David brings the ark into the city of Jerusalem. So it appears to be after the Shiloh thing, and before David's conquest of Jerusalem, so sometime in there. Which means, what Bible character was a prophet? And by the way, the word of the Lord was rare in those days. Can you think of a prophet who might have been inspired to write this account of this 300 to 400 year period of the judges, who lived during the time, I guess I would say after David after the ark was taken in Shiloh, but before David became king in Jerusalem. Who might that be?
Samuel.
Obvious answer, Samuel. So that's one of the reasons that the book is sometimes thought to be written by Samuel. It definitely was during that time. Now, we'll just say this. From the standpoint of propaganda, this book looks very good for David, for Jerusalem, for Hebron, for Judah, against Benjamites, especially if you read the last few chapters, who were the tribe of Saul. So if you see this in the period of transition between Saul and David, you can kind of see by reading this book that, man, Judah's who you want in charge, isn't it? Not these crazy Benjamites, right? And you're going to see that obviously near the end of the book. So Saul, remember, a Benjamite. Both Sauls were Benjamites. Isn't that true? Am I wrong about that? I think they were.
They were.
Anyway. Okay, so enough of that. I'll throw this out just so you know. Another link is that many of these descriptions in this first chapter of Judges are really just repetitions of some things mentioned in the book of Joshua, including the incomplete conquest. And I think that's because two reasons. I think because he's just, it fits into the story. Well, maybe that's the same reason, really. He's doing a south to north description of the conquest or incomplete conquest, but it also fits the theme. And you'll see there's a sequence of, more and more failures as it goes forward. But it started in the time of Joshua, basically. Nor did Zebulun drive out the inhabitants of Kitron or the inhabitants of Nahalol, or so the Canaanites dwelt among them and were put under tribute. Nor did Asher drive out the inhabitants of Akko or Sidon or Aklab or Achzib or Helba, Aphek or Rehob. So the Asherites dwelt among the Canaanites and the inhabitants of the land, for they did not drive them out. Nor did Naphtali drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh or the inhabitants of Beth Anath, but they dwelt among the Canaanites, inhabitants of the land. Nevertheless, the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh and Beth Anath were put under tribute to them. And the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountains, for they would not allow them to come down to the valley. And the Amorites were determined to dwell in Mount Heres and Aijalon and Shalbim. Yet, when the strength of the house of Joseph became greater, they were put under tribute. Now, the boundary of the Amorites was from the ascent of Akrabim from Selah upward. Now, what's interesting is we got all the way to the north, we got all the way to Naphtali, and then we come back and describe Dan. You remember Dan was down in the south, over there to the west of Benjamin? Why is Dan listed last, even though it's way down in the south? Because it looked like the author had a nice sequence going from south to north, and then he comes back and covers Dan down. I wonder why that would be. Well, don't know, but one thing thematically, notice that in a few cases, the Israelites couldn't drive them out. A few cases put them under forced labor. But the case of Dan's like the worst of all. Not only did they not drive them out, not even put them under forced labor, not even just dwell with them in peace, they got run out themselves. You know what I'm talking about? That's what he's saying here. And this has to do with the southern part, but still later in the book, in chapters 17 and 18, we're going to find out they didn't just get run out of the mountain territory down in the, near the territory of Ephraim. They got run out of the south altogether, all the way up north of Lake Huleh, way into the northern part of Israel. So you see thematically what the author is doing here is he's showing Judah, good story. That was those blue font things I showed you before. But the farther north you go, the worse it was. And then he ends up with Dan, who was started in the south and got, by the end of the book, gets run up far to the north. And I'll make one other point. You remember what city we started with in this sequence of northern tribes? What was the first city mentioned several times? Jacob's dream, all that. Do I have to go back? Bethel, remember that? And what do we end with? We end with Dan. I wonder if Dan and Bethel has any kind of way of bookending something, right? Yeah. You remember in the time of Jeroboam, Dan and Bethel were the southern and northern boundaries of the northern kingdom and where the golden calves were set up to keep the northern kingdom Israelites from wanting to come back to observe the Passover feast and other things in Jerusalem. So don't know if that's significant, but whoever wrote this kind of knew what they were doing. I mean, there's a lot of interesting geography that looks back and also looks forward. Now, moving on to chapter 2, the angel of the Lord, I wonder what the angel of the Lord came, and by the way, of Yahweh, the angel of Yahweh, came up from Gilgal to Bochim. You notice that I am on Bochim, plural. It's a plural word. And said, I led you up from Egypt and brought you to the land of which I swore to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you. And you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of the land. You shall tear down their altars. But you have not obeyed my voice. Why have you done this? Therefore, I also said, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall be thorns in your side, and their God shall be a snare to you. And so it was, when the angel of the Lord spoke these words to the children of Israel, the people lifted up their voices and wept. And they called the name of that place Bochim, and they sacrificed there to the Lord. And when Joshua had dismissed the people, the children of Israel went each to his own inheritance to possess the land. You see that there's like a trip that this angel has taken. And this angel started in Gilgal. You remember we pointed out Gilgal on the map before. What had happened at Gilgal? And why is this angel migrating from Gilgal to Bochim? Had an angel appeared at Gilgal? Was there an appearance of an angel at Gilgal? Maybe it's the same one, right? So let's look at what happened at Gilgal to understand maybe what this text is about. By the way, I'll just mention that Gilgal, another Hebrew word now we know, means rolling. And we'll figure out why in just a second. And Bochim means weepers because the people wept, and it's a plural word for weeping, or people who weep. So there's two more Hebrew words we know, Gilgal and Bochim. You go back to Joshua 4 and 5, really, the children now have crossed the Jordan. You remember the waters had kind of receded upstream. They picked up 12 stones. You remember that from the middle of and so they carried them across. And in chapter 4, verse 19 of Joshua now, I'm not in Judges, I'm in Joshua. The people came up from the Jordan on the 10th day, and they camped in Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. And you know what's about to happen is they're going to go march around Jericho, and the walls will fall, and that begins the conquest. But before that, something important happens at Gilgal. Those 12 stones that they took out of the Jordan, Joshua set up at Gilgal. So there's kind of a monument, and I'm skipping over the part where he says, and when your children ask, what is the meaning of this? You remember that part, right? So it's a kind of a memorial for that miracle that God did there in bringing them in from the east to the west into the promised land. And so they're camped there, spread out all through that flat area. I hope you saw that on the map, how flat it is in that Jordan Valley there. I guess it's fertile as well because it looks like they grew plants. You'll see in just a minute. It's also a place where they could all spread out. And Moses went up on Mount Nebo just to the east there, and you could see them all spread out there. Nebo's a pretty high mountain. By the way, the same mountain that Balaam went up, right? Balak, I think, took him up there and said, look at these people. You know, they're threatening. So anyway, so chapter 5, what they did is they circumcised all these men. Of course, everyone who was older than 20 at the failure at Kadesh Barnea had died, but apparently they hadn't been circumcising the men since that time of Altar of the Wandering. So when they finished circumcising the people, they stayed in their place in the camp and till they were healed. Then the Lord said to Joshua, this day I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. Therefore, the name of this place is called Gilgal. So Gilgal is a happy word. It means the curse is rolled away. Circumcision was renewed. And that dates back to the Abrahamic covenant. And they camped in Gilgal and kept the Passover. Now, I guess they hadn't been doing that since that one Passover when they escaped from Egypt on the 14th day of the month at twilight. And they ate of the produce of the land, maybe a fertile area, on the day after the Passover, unleavened bread and parched grain on the very same day. And the manna ceased on the day after they'd eaten the produce of the land. The children of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate the food of Canaan that year. And then it came to pass, when Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, a man stood opposite him with his sword in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said, are you for us or our adversaries? He said, no, I'm the commander of the army of the Lord. I have now come. You see, that's the other angel of the Lord. Maybe this is the Gilgal angel that comes to Bochim in the book of Judges. See, but you see the difference now. In this case, they renewed the covenant, right? God has let their adolescents, and they're moving out of the house, and God's cutting off their, you know, their cash each month, right? No more manna. You got to live on your own. You got to conquer the land, or you won't be able to eat. And so they're growing up, and as they move into the land. But Joshua meets, he has his burning bush experience, like Moses did, told to take off his shoes, and he meets the command of the Lord's army and said, I'm going to fight for you. And so that's what happened at Gilgal. And now you understand that when the angel comes up from Gilgal to Bochim, that is a symbolic picture of coming from a place of optimism and hope and covenant renewal and faithfulness to a place of broken covenant and curse, right, and despair, and people that will be left in the land and be a thorn in your side, we'll read in just a minute. So that's why they were weeping. I assume the same angel, but it connects those two stories there before the conquest now and probably 16 or so years later, a little bit more later. So that's Gilgal. So this, and I remember Joshua's in that last story there, there at Bochim. So the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord, which he had done for Israel. Now Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died when he was 110 years old. By the way, I'm back in Judges. I hope you caught that, even though we're describing Joshua dying again. But anyway, but we're in Judges because he's making this point, as you can see, that here I am. I'm not finished reading. I'm telling you that the faithfulness of that generation maybe was the best it ever was in all of Israel. I don't know. And those who remembered, right, maybe the next generation. But after that, you see a generational decline after that. And they buried him within the border of his inheritance at Timnath-Heres in the mountains of Ephraim on the north. Remember, he's an Ephraimite on the north side of Mount Gaash. When all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation now rose after them that did not know the Lord nor the work which he had done for Israel. Is it the case that most of the time the next generation is going to be much more loose in their morals, in their zeal for the Lord, in their interpretation of Scripture? I don't mean to say that there aren't generations of reform, but look around. How often is it that the next generation says, you know, Mom and Dad, I don't think you're interpreting the Scripture strictly enough. I don't think you're zealous enough in your work. And I told this to the high school class. I think I offended them. But I said, how many times does the young generation say to themselves, man, it's pretty clear to me, Mom and Dad have gotten it all wrong. They're way too strict. We don't need to follow all this stuff. You know what I mean? How, of those two situations, which is the most likely to happen? It happens all the time, more frequently. And here in the book of Judges, you see that the memory of Joshua, the conquest, the signs that had been done, the dedication to the law, is lost from one generation to the next. We'll see that in the spiral we're about to read about. Is it gets worse each time. I don't know, maybe you can contradict me on that, but it just seems like each generation gets worse until God takes some action and he destroys everything and then it's recreated somehow. He'd just done it, right, in the wilderness, right? He'd kind of destroyed the nation and recreated it in the generation of Joshua, and he's going to have to do it again and again in their history. And it makes it important to me to remember what Moses was saying about teach your children diligently. You know, when you lie down, when you rise up, write it on the doorposts of your house, on your gates. There's no end to the teaching that's needed and explanations that are needed. Okay. I don't think I'll read this whole thing, but it is a verbal description of the little cycle that's shown on the right. But you can just read the red, did evil, forsook, followed God, served Baal. And then God delivered them, sold them into the hands of their enemies. The Lord was against them for calamity. I think in verse 15, they were greatly distressed. And then the Lord raised up judges who delivered them. And that phrase will help us define the word judges in the book. Although I think there's evidence that Deborah and Jair and a few others actually did judge in some kind of a civil sense of keeping order in civil issues. But still, in this case, it's pretty clear he means that the judges who raised up, they were deliverers. They were saviors. They rescued the people. I would say, with God's help. But then, verse 17, the people turned quickly. You see, I'm just reading the red. I should be pointing and marking on. They turned quickly. And they, you know, then the Lord raised up judges. He was with the judge, delivered them. The Lord heard their groaning. That's kind of, and then when the judge was dead, guess what? They reverted and behaved what? More corruptly. Do you see that? You can see a spiral here, but the spiral doesn't go right back up to his high point on the top. It doesn't go quite as high. The bottom goes lower each time. They did more corruptly by following other gods and bowing down to them and so on. So that's a description of the, so the word judge, just to have a little background, small commercial break, is Shaphat, apparently is how you pronounce it. And it really means pronouncing sentence, but by implication meaning to vindicate or punish. And so therefore, if you have a cause that's just, a judge comes in and makes sure everything is right. And it might mean punishing your enemy, which is the case for a lot of situations here. So before we get to chapter 3, I'll just mention that if you go through that section, here are the things that Israelites did wrong. They did not know Jehovah or his works. Now, is that because they weren't there when they happened, or they just refused to have God in their knowledge? Seems to me it has to be the latter. They served the Baals and Ashtoreth, which is the male and female versions. Baal just kind of means Lord or husband or master, I think. And so they're Baals plural, meaning each city or region would have their own local deity.
Marty, can I ask you a really quick question on that?
Yes, you can. I won't be able to give you a quick answer, I'm pretty sure.
Well, you might. So in the time of Jezebel, I thought that it said that's when, like, the Baals were introduced, like, Baal worship. Was it, like, an institutionalized worship at the time, but they served them at other times before that? Or is that just they always served them from the judges on?
Yeah, my answer is going to be real short. I don't know. I think that institutional explanation sounds pretty good. I mean, the fact that Ahab, you know, was the king, and that these were imported as a nationalized thing, and Jezebel not only supported the priests, but also killed the priests of Jehovah, right? So maybe that's the sense of it. It was governmental support.
Okay.
Question. I'll see if I can find out a better answer. They did not obey Jehovah as their fathers had. And then I think the key element that illustrates that is they made covenants and they gave and took daughters and sons in marriage, which is, of course, one of the strongest of covenants. And I'll mention again the fact that the Kenites are dwelling among them. We know that Rahab and her family are part of the group. Kenites meaning Jethro and his people. The other book that occurred during this time is the Book of Ruth. So it wasn't the fact that they weren't Jewish people per se. And the Book of Deuteronomy talks about how a person could accept Jehovah, a wife, for example, even one captured in battle. She had to think about it for about a month or more and change her clothes and do some things that seemed to me allowed her to contemplate whether that's really what she wanted. Would she really believe in this Yahweh or not? And if so, what would be welcomed into the nation as it stood? But the danger was where it was nothing but, a physical relationship or maybe a romantic relationship. Doesn't really matter. But it did not include accepting Yahweh and would represent a temptation to idolatry. Then the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel. And he said, because this nation has transgressed my covenant, which I commanded their fathers, and has not heeded my voice, I will also no longer drive out before them any of the nations which Joshua left when he died, so that through them I may test Israel, whether they will keep the ways of the Lord, to walk in them as their fathers kept them or not. Therefore the Lord left those nations without driving them out immediately, nor did he deliver them into the hand of Joshua. I guess the point I would make about this section is that we can mess up as individuals and we can repent. We can get ourselves in a big old mess, into distress, and cry out to the Lord and repent. And maybe he'll rescue us. But are things really ever as good as they would have been if we hadn't gone through that cycle? It seems to me in each of these cases, and finally, the spiral is such that this temptation stays in their face the rest of the existence of the nation. I think we can make a personal application. There are things we can do wrong, and we can repent, and we can be rescued by God, but it will put more temptation on us the rest of our lives. And it will leave scars and dangers and difficulties. Of course, you can imagine the application of the high school kids who are just beginning. They're just reaching the age where they can make decisions in which they can do deep damage to themselves and others. And they can repent, and God wants them to come back. But it will leave things worse than they were at the beginning. And I think that's kind of the overarching lesson from this section. So here are the nations that are left. This is a map of the tribes. I think I have to give Danny credit for almost every map in this thing. But look, if you overlay the nations, here are the nations that are left. It's pretty terrible, huh? And we'll read about many of these, of course. Samson, the Philistines, Jephthah and the Moabites, Gideon and the Canaanites. Barak and the Canaanites. Gideon fought the Midianites, who aren't even, they're off from off the map, right? And Othniel, they came from Mesopotamia, so even people from the outside. But the Amorites seem to be everywhere, and the Canaanites as well. So that was a problem for them. And this is the last section. Now, these are the nations which the Lord left, that he might test Israel by them, that is, all who had not known any of the wars of Canaan. This was only so the generations of the children of Israel might be taught to know war, at least those who had not formerly known it. Namely, five lords of the Philistines. I forgot to mention this. You notice Judah got three of the cities of the Philistines earlier on. There were two more they didn't get. It's kind of the implication. There were five of the cities of the Philistines. It's pretty clear they didn't hold them. You remember Samson had some exploits at Ascalon and Gaza, if I remember right. So they're still later going to be retaken. But anyway, so the Philistines, the Canaanites, the Sidonians, up in the territory of Asher, and the Hivites who dwelt in Mount Lebanon, from Mount Baal Hermon to the entrance of Hamath, and they were left, and he might test Israel by them to know whether they would obey the commandments of the Lord, which he had commanded their fathers by the hand of Moses. And thus the children of Israel dwelt among the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and the Jebusites of all people. They can't have been a very big tribe if they just lived in Jerusalem, but still they're listed. And they took their daughters to be wives and gave their daughters to their sons. Is this forbidding interracial marriage, or is there something else going on here? And they served their gods. That's the problem. That's the difficulty. And you can see from those other examples that was not really the case. Okay. I'm done. Now for time for a quiz. So you can type the answers or shout them out, and the faster we do it, the quicker we'll get to go to bed. Yes. All right. So define the term judge as used in the book.
Avenger.
Yeah, avenger, deliverer, any of those things. Yes, the three major sections of Judges. I don't guess we came up with real easy words for that. But there's the conditions in Israel, the major section of the Judges, and then there's this conditions in Israel again, but it's the cultural conditions in Israel at the end. Micah and the Danites and the crime at Gibeah. Okay, so three sections. I think I'm going to skip number three. I think we got that. What are the two events? Can you remember the two events that bound the time of writing of the Judges? What are those two events?
The Ark was in Shiloh.
Good.
Before the Jebusites left.
Great. They actually got conquered by David, or David's men in Jerusalem. Good. So it was after the Ark was at Shiloh and before that happened. Okay, I'm going to skip number five. Number six, what does Gilgal mean and what does Bochim mean?
Rolling and weepers.
Weepers, right. What's the geographical order of chapter one?
South
to north. Whoever said it, great, thanks.
South to north.
Where are the two cities of Judah's conquest that begin and end the narrative? The two cities.
Hebron and Jerusalem.
Good. Hebron and Jerusalem. Important in David's reign, which is about the time of the writing of the book, but also important in Israel's history. The two locations that begin and end the narrative of the northern tribes, quote, conquest, which weren't much conquest, but what were
Dan
they?
Dan and Bethel.
Dan and Bethel, thank you. The tribe that did the best at conquest.
Judah.
Worst at conquest.
Dan.
Great. The types of disobedience of the Israelites. Well, we listed those, but they didn't obey. They didn't know the Lord. They made covenants and marriages and, worshiped the Baals and Ashtaroth. What do these Hebrew words mean? Beth?
House.
El?
God.
God, or Elohim is a plural form. Adonai?
Lord.
Good. Kirjath?
City.
Negev?
South.
Which means south. That's good. All right. I'm done. I actually have other charts, but I'm ashamed to show you because it will illustrate how poorly I can plan for a 1 hour long class. But anyway, all right. Maybe we'll start with them next time. We didn't do our group exercise, so maybe we'll start with that next time. I want you to think about how we can apply this book in our lives or in our world, maybe in our church. What are the lessons as you've kind of seen an overview, at least the beginning of it, and you probably know the stories of the judges. All right, I've gone over. I'm done. Any questions or anything that you want to, anybody want to make everybody mad by asking another question?
Great job, Marty.
I think you did good.
Yeah, amen.
I was going to say school hasn't started yet, so we can stay up later.
Yeah, very few of us probably have to drive to work. I know Teresa starts early, but anyway.
Yeah.
All right. Yep, so you may want to watch the movie. And so the next lesson, if I can find the right chart here, is we're going to go all the way through Deborah and Barak, which is through chapter 5. So it'll be 3:7 through the end of chapter 5. We got the three smaller judges, less about them, and then Deborah and Barak. Okay?
Okay.